propaganda versus the truth. You're with Swedish-British journalist Pelle Nyroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor Show. From Sweden on this May afternoon, spring's well advanced here. It's 21st of May, and we've got four fabulous guests today. We've got Natalia Nazarenko from the Geneva Project, who is going to go to the WHO conference starting next week in that Swiss city and protest against the pandemic treaty, which a lot of people are quite rightly worried about, given the extent of government lying to us on lockdowns, masks, and the efficacy of vaccines. Is this the beginning of a health totalitarianism? Well, can't say for sure, but it's good that people are giving a shout out and warning about it. So she'll be talking to us. She's got the Geneva Project. Her name is Andrea Nazarenko. That's next week. We've got Brandon Weichart, who is an Iranian expert. And of course, Raisi, the Iranian president, was killed either in a crash or an assassination. We don't know yet. He thinks it could be a Franz Ferdinand moment, but we haven't seen a lot of anxiety, almost a sort of coordinated lack of interest from both the Russians and the Americans, and the Israelis have kept very quiet. So it could be an accident, it could be a murder. We don't know yet. And he'll be telling us some other issues related to the Middle East. We've got Paul Thacker, who is an investigative reporter and writes the Disinformation Chronicle. And if you ever want sort of information you can take to the bank about what's really going on in the world, at least the correct version of our narratives on the COVID, his is the place to go to. And it's incredibly good and accurate, I find, and very critical of the way that even the science journals, which are at the absolute pinnacle of scientific credibility, which literally every scientist in the Western world aspires to be published in, well, they are not always accurate, especially on politically sensitive subjects. And he'll be telling us about that. And finally, we've got Willem Steenkamp, who's an ambassador, a former senior South African intelligence official during apartheid, been very critical of Israel because he thinks they're mismanaging it. Transition to a more democratic system is inevitable, as it was in South Africa. But he's going to tell us about the South African election, which is just taking place next week. And there are threats there to the stability of that country as global South, as where sentiments take hold. And the Africanist psychology, which is rather racialist, takes over from the rather moderate ANC, corrupt as they have been, who've ruled since 1994. And we'll be talking to him about that very interestingly. We have a special affinity with South Africa on this program. But I want to, before we go over to Basil, who's with us from Basil Valentine, our political editor, who's taking a break from some of his political duties and has been to the Cannes Film Festival, the world's premier film festival in the south of France. And there have been political films and other films and lots of hobnobbing and mixing and making contacts. And he'll tell us all about that. And we'll have a little film session. But before that, I just want to talk a little bit about tourism, which is obviously we're heading into the tourist season. And an interesting article caught my eye, which is that Amsterdam is spamming the Western world as advertising outlets and social media and television channels with campaign to try and get people, the young men, sort of stagnators, you know, who go to Amsterdam to sample the prostitutes, walk around the red light district, drink a lot and smoke marijuana and sort of vomit into the canals. Well, they're not welcome. So the Amsterdam Tourist Office has created a quiz asking questions of what sort of holiday people imagine they're doing. And then every time they presumably say, yes, I want to smoke marijuana, gives a sort of correction saying, well, you know, the new Amsterdam is not like that anymore. And although the quiz is called the Amsterdam Rules, meant to appear in search results about the city, if you respond for a stag party, a pub crawl, or a smoked marijuana in public, you'll be told to be disappointed because it's no longer allowed. And from what I understand from this article, which is in The Guardian, incidentally, is that some of those restrictions will be quietly rolled back. For instance, it's quite hard to police marijuana consumption on the streets because it's permitted elsewhere in Amsterdam. And the local businesses are much against early closing hours and so on. But I just want to say a few things about the bigger story, which is in Europe in the 21st century, tourism is sort of not quite. I don't know. It's increasingly controversial, put it that way. I mean, I was in Spain recently, and there are even political parties that have started up that have quite violently racist comments about North European tourists, you know, using the language reserved usually by the far right against, let's say, Muslims. Because after all, you know, what do the North Europeans do? We don't have much larger incomes than the Spanish anymore. We go down there and pay very badly, and we don't speak the local language. So, is it not the understandable hostility there, the same kind of universal hostility we're seeing growing everywhere against, let's say, migrants, which is people who kind of don't kind of fit in, and now the Spanish, who are very, very poor in the 1970s, they've caught up. It's striking how modern the country is, and well adjusted generally, and well off and clean and everything. And they don't like the tourism at all. And of course, it's disfigured much of their once beautiful coastline. And I remember, I just want to say another thing, which is I was in Prague back in 1990, when just after the communist revolution. Anti-communist revolution and democracy had just arrived, and the city was literally empty. And you have to remember, thinking back, Eastern Europe is part of our common Europe, if you like. But back then, Eastern Europe was completely unknown. It'd been behind the Iron Curtain, so we barely knew that cities like Prague existed. The fact that it was this fantastic Baroque jewel with 16th-century architecture, completely unspoilt by traffic or commercial activity or cars—that's thanks to communism in a way. The center, it was an absolute, it was like a walking around in a fairy tale. And there were no tourists, but there were a lot of pubs and restaurants, or a few, and they're just sitting around and enjoying life. And I went there a couple of years later, and it was absolutely deluged with supermarket trinket stands and cheap restaurants and tour guides and people wandering around aimlessly, you know, between drinks. Because, of course, a tourist, in a way, is a person who's been denuded of his identity back home. He's got a job back home and works on that, and everyone knows where he is. But all of us, when we go to a new country and are tourists, we have our cameras, and we're often quite ignorant about the local culture. So in a way, we're all like giant babies, and it's this, I don't know, destructive thing. So well, the Amsterdam this article suggests that Schiphol, the Amsterdam airport, be downsized to take in fewer tourists. And basically restore Amsterdam to its sort of renaissance or whatever glory with far fewer tourists. And I think that's going to go a bit far. And of course, though, there's eternal growth activists who say this is typical left-wingery, anti-growth, anti-capitalism. But I have to say, just on an aesthetic level, I can sympathize with the sentiment of this article about less tourism. Mind you, we all want to travel. We just want to be tourists. And I want to go to other places. So a bit of hypocrisy there. Anyways, we're going to go to another place which has seen a lot of tourism, and that's the south of France. And our political editor turned temporary film critic, Basil Valentine, is talking to us from Cannes, or at least near Cannes, Saint-Jean-le-Pin. Welcome to the show, Basil.
Good afternoon, Pelle. It's great to be with you. Yes, the linen jacket is a bit of a giveaway, isn't it? Very Our Man in Havana. And
That's right.
I have indeed decamped here to the Côte d'Azur for a few days, and an extremely agreeable part of the world it is too, not least because of the boulangerie and pâtissière.
I guess well, have you caught up in any interesting films? Any or any well, how since you're a political editor, how has politics affected Cannes?
A very good question. I went yesterday to a reception for the whole question of filmmaking around political issues and, in particular, displaced people. A Q&A was hosted by Cate Blanchett at one of the extremely opulent installations down there on the beach on the Croisette. I was fortunate enough to be invited as a result of a serendipitous meeting with Beth Portello, who is the co-founder of Cinema Libre, a political film studio, 25 years established now, founded by Beth and her husband, Philippe Diaz. Now, Philippe has just completed a new film called I Am Gitmo, which is a factionalized account of events at Guantanamo Bay. Very important subject, one largely forgotten these days, but there are, in fact, still around 30 people being held in Guantanamo Bay, Pelle, without charge, tortured,
Incredible.
And nobody seems to know or care about their fate, bar one or two campaigning organizations like Reprieve. So
that's incredible. So do we know more about these people who are still out there? I mean, what on earth could they have committed to justify that 22-year incarceration? Or
well, exactly, Pelle, nothing, effectively. They were often just rounded up from likely, you know, places, often talked about by their neighbours as possibly being terrorists, and the film highlights this. So I believe that rewards were paid in Afghanistan and Iraq for any information leading to the arrest of so-called terrorists. So basically, if you grasped on your neighbour and said, oh, he's actually with bin Laden, you got a few $1,000s. Well, obviously, this was entirely open to abuse. Worth remembering, too, of course, in my view, and those of many other independent researchers, nobody in Afghanistan had anything to do with 9/11. So, you know, the fact, exactly. Likewise, Iraq. So, you know, exactly. Why people in Iraq and Afghanistan were arrested on so-called terrorism charges is beyond belief. They were then shipped off via Bagram Air Force Base to Guantanamo Bay, where they were officially categorized, believe it or not, Pelle, as non-human beings. And that allowed the United States authorities to treat them in subhuman, in other words, inhuman ways. Well, Philippe's film, I should say, I Am Gitmo, meticulously researched and beautifully shot. It's a difficult watch. It's meant to be a difficult watch. We interviewed him here on TNT on Sunday afternoon on Lembit's program. You can go back and find that, Philip Diaz with Lembit Opik. And we will have him on again because a particularly humane and erudite individual he is too. So Philip is actually in Los Angeles at the moment, but it was through meeting his wife and co-founder of Cinema Libre we were able to get that interview and find out about the whole political film scene here at Cannes, because documentaries, of course, are an increasing part of film distribution worldwide.
Well, I advise you to go to Lembit's show then to find out more about the interviews and that documentary film about Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, which is the US prison for the 9/11 so-called terrorists. But Basil, what about Ukraine? And well, it's almost certainly too soon to have got anything done and then distributed. But have Ukraine and Israel made their presence felt either in the fictional part of the Cannes Film Festival and the documentary part?
Not that I've seen particularly. I mean, I've no doubt they are out there, but Cannes is huge, Pelle. No one can possibly take it all in. It's a combination of competition. Films are selected for competition and prizes are awarded, you know, similar to the Oscars, but Cannes likes to think it has, well, I'm sure it does have different criteria, different judges, and tends to prefer more artistic films. But it's that, it's also a marketplace. There are literally hundreds of screenings of films seeking distribution. If you've made a film, you've already spent your $5 or $10 million or whatever, or sometimes just a few hundred thousand, you want distribution. So you bring the film to Cannes and you show it to one of these dozens of cinemas, films playing literally from 9 o'clock in the morning right the way through till the small hours. And you hope that somebody's going to pick it up. Meanwhile, there's also a trade fair. Microsoft have been here demonstrating the benefits of AI in filmmaking in the future. There are countries advertising, you know, as in trade fairs, to come and film in their country. Come to Thailand to film. We have cheap technicians, great locations, and everything else. Got to film in Thailand. So it's just absolutely everything and everything you could imagine to do with film.
Well, it's interesting.
Of course, impossibly glamorous with women in evening gowns walking down the...
I was going to say, get cut. Cut to the interesting stuff, you know. Who's the starlet of the year? I bet you took a walk down the Croisette to see who had the longest legs, sort of thing, on the beach. You know, there's that famously, isn't there, that There's a lot of photo shoots on that beach. Well, it's
interesting,
yes, absolutely.
Isn't it? And I mean, yeah. There is a huge amount of vanity wrapped up with the film industry. It's as simple as that. There's huge amounts of ego and preening and posing and all the rest of it. I mean, the first morning I went down there, somebody had set up a couple of chairs on the pavement, on the promenade right there on the Croisette, obviously for interview purposes, somewhat blocking the walkway, I should add. And they had about 9 or 10 very expensive looking, very complex cameras pointing at these two chairs from all angles, so that they can cut together exactly the right shots for the interview and all the rest of it. And that in many ways summed up Cannes, a lot more about style rather than substance. And speaking to Beth Portello, herself a producer and co-founder of Cinema Libre Studio, she said that among the cognoscenti, no single film had bowled people over at Cannes. There was no sort of word on the street that you must go and see this. This is absolutely brilliant. Not a single film, believe it or not.
Isn't it good to get away from all this stuff? I mean, we're so serious and we're so much doom and gloom. And then you go out of the studio and you travel to somewhere like Cannes. I mean, like I traveled around Europe last year, having spent immersed in doom and gloom of current affairs. And you realize that people, there's still a lot of glamour out there, still a lot of money, still a lot of people who live on a different plane than us political hacks. And isn't that what life is about as well? I mean, you know, if we're all incredibly serious and reading the war headlines and had astute analyses of what's going on in the Iranian elections or the Georgian color revolution and whatsoever, you know, but it's good that there are other things, other lives. And it must do you feel like a fish out of water or whatever? Or do you feel relaxed?
Well, this is it. I mean, to be honest, I like the whole thing in the final analysis. Yeah. Cannes is a lovely, lovely town. It's very attractive buildings. These wonderful Belle Epoque hotels like the Carlton and very affluent feel walking up and down the streets. Very few empty shops, and when they are empty they get taken on very quickly. A very pretty old town. It's not all completely sort of priced out of the ordinary person. You can wander into the old town and sit down and have a formule du jour of three dishes with wine for 25 euros. It's not sort of
That's enough, Basil. You're going to make me jump out of my studio and rendezvous with you. I remember bouillabaisse I had in Cannes some time ago, and I can already taste it. Anyway, Basil, we'll have you on in the next hour and for more talk, I think, on the more serious topic of the latest in Middle Eastern developments. Thanks a lot, Basil. Talk to you soon.
Thank
and
you.
This is the Pelle Nero's Taylor Show on Tuesday afternoon, and we've got our first guest coming up very shortly.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's news talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
As a combat wounded veteran, I know how hard it is to come home and build a meaningful life. When I was in Iraq, our vehicle was hit. A rocket-propelled grenade exploded right under my seat. Traumatic brain injury, a fractured pelvis, severe burns. They didn't think I was going to make it. I had to learn to walk again and live with the scars, both visible and invisible.
DAV helps veterans like LaToya get the benefits they've earned. They help more than 1 million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
With DAV on my side, I was able to pursue my dreams. If my story can touch a heart, it can change a life. My victory is overcoming my wounds so I can help other veterans.
LaToya Lucas, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
The human mind is like a computer. No matter how efficient it may be, its reliability is only as great as the information fed into it.
That's a campaign promise.
Tell us the truth. Tell us the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
You're hearing it.
TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroff Taylor Show. Well, in Geneva coming up in the next week or so, we've got the 77th World Health Assembly meeting in Geneva. It's sort of thing that only the most fervent bureaucrats and health officials would worry about. But of course, since the COVID pandemic, we're all incredibly suspicious of what bureaucrats are up to and planning, and politicians are up to, planning on our behalf because they got the COVID pandemic or plandemic or scamdemic or whatever so wrong, with lockdowns and masks and a massive economic failure, and the vaccines incredibly contentious, don't seem to do any good. Even very sophisticated health experts like Martin Kulldorff says that the mRNA at the very best doesn't decrease mortality, and it could be quite dangerous. Well, so they're meeting up again to look at how they can collectively, the world's 194 member nations of the World Health Organization, can fight the future unknown pathogen that's a successor, as it were, to COVID, which they called disease X. Now, signatories would set up in the national, regional, and global networks to share information on viruses of concern, including the genomic information of those viruses. Well, that's what the officials themselves say. It's more of an advisory thing. It's more to help us all. But of course, there's a large subsection of people who think that this is the beginning of a kind of totalitarian control. And who can blame them? Because governments have lied to us so much in the past. So I'd like to welcome Andrea Nazarenko, who is going to Geneva. She's in South Carolina at the moment, and is going to start a march or a protest called the Geneva Project. Thank you very much for joining us, Andrea.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So you're in South Carolina at the moment, and you're heading off to Geneva, and you're going to participate in a huge march on the 1st of June, I think, in the in the main square of the UN quarter in Geneva. Can you tell us about what you're doing and what you hope to achieve?
Absolutely. So I am working with a team of international folks. We've got representatives from all over the world, all over Europe, as far as Australia, New Zealand, and even teamed up with the folks in Japan to really say that the future world that the WHO and the UN have designed for the people doesn't really represent the voice of the people. It doesn't represent our individual sovereignty, our individual differences, as well as our national sovereignty and our cultural heritages and who we are and our identity. And the concept that they've created simply does not represent the future world that we want to leave for future generations. So we are flooding to Geneva. We are calling it a people's convoy in, meaning we are paying homage to the convoys of the past, but we are coming in not in direct opposition, instead in unity, in harmony, in nonviolence, as the 8 billion people of the world uniting and saying, we're going to develop our own counter concept for the future. At the end of the day, we are 8 billion people, and the future belongs to us, and we do not need to concede to a future designed by a select few that benefits them. We hold the power to create the future that we want to see.
What some of the skeptics of what the WHO are up to, talking about it being it's going to speed up the next set of vaccination project. And of course, one of the reasons why it so desperately failed and caused so many deaths among the younger population is because it was speeded up, precisely because it was speeded up. They're talking about censorship, which they won't call that. They call it limiting disinformation. And they talk about it's going to be a surveillance, well, a sort of, beginning of this world government with inability to travel freely because we have to have vaccine passports. And so some people have built up this dystopian, and I think they're right to do so, even if some people might call it conspiracy theory, because they've said it's better to talk about it and then row back than have it sprung upon us because we didn't take this seriously enough. Are you going to be, because of course the WHO officials are saying, well, no, it's more of an advisory thing that we're doing, but we know that we can't trust our governments. What's your view on how serious it is in terms of actual legislation that will limit our freedoms?
Well, how I like to describe what they're doing is sort of like, you know, when you play sports, you know, I have three little kids, so I use a lot of family references, but think back to when you played sports, if you were an athlete, and after the game, what your coach would do was the next practice, you would watch the tapes, you would study what went well, what didn't go well. So next time you have a game, next time you play that team, you know how to go around their opposition, you know how to fight harder, fight stronger, what worked well, what didn't work well. You evaluate what happened. And that is largely what they are doing right now. They are evaluating their strategies. They are engaging a lot of propaganda tactics, like calling things disinformation, dehumanizing those who dissent what they're doing. They're using a lot of the same propaganda playbook that we've seen time and time again across history and the social sciences to step into the future so that the next pandemic, whatever, or the next global emergency, I should call it, whatever that may be, takes into account their weaknesses this time around, because our side has certainly fought hard during the pandemic. We overcame the passports. We overcame the masking. We got rid of the mandates. And so they're setting both legal precedences and being very planful and proactive so that they could be stronger and fight harder next time. And so we need to do the same on our side. We need to study what went well, what didn't go well, and propose a counter concept that we are working for. Because what we know is that the globalists and those bureaucrats who sit in, you know, in the WHO and these other private public partnerships, they have their best interests at heart. They have self-gain at heart. They don't necessarily have the voice of people in the center of what they're doing. So it's time that we reclaim that as ours.
Absolutely. Right. I'm going to pick up on the thing where you said you got rid of the mandates. But we've got to go into a quick news break, so prepare that, and we'll talk about it after the break. This is the Pelle Nero Taylor Show on TNT News Talk, and we're talking about the upcoming pandemic meeting in Geneva on the 27th of May and for a couple of days ahead, and what we're doing to protest against that. This we're back after the quick news break.
What brings you here?
News entirely.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a quick look at your TNT headlines. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu slammed the International Criminal Court after its chief prosecutor sought a warrant for his arrest over alleged war crimes in Gaza.
What a travesty of justice. What a disgrace.
Iran's supreme leader has declared 5 days of mourning following the sudden death of the country's president. And WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was handed a win on Monday, with the UK's High Court ruling he has the right to appeal his extradition to the US.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nero Taylor Show on this Tuesday afternoon. We're talking to Andrea Nazarenko, who's a doctorate, and who is an official and head of the Geneva Project, which is a sort of people's revolt or people's demonstration against the anonymous bureaucrats of the WHO, or WHO, which is the World Health Organization, which is based in that Swiss French-speaking city, and according to detractors, are planning a dystopian future of pandemic regulation for the upcoming disease X, whatever that may be. So, Andrea, you were saying that you had some victories under your belt, as it were, the getting rid of the mandates and the masks and so on. Who's the we there? What are you talking? Can you just be more specific?
The we are the people of the world. So what they tried to do was really lock us down hard last time, right? They locked us down, they masked our children, they tried to mass vaccinate the global population. But there was a small few at the beginning that grew in numbers to put their foot down and say, we will not comply, we will hold the line and we will not get this vaccine. We will not vaccinate our children and we will not comply with your lockdowns any longer. So it was a process. You know, they tried everything in their control to restrict us, to restrict our travel, to restrict our families. They used emotional marketing and tactics. And we continue to grow in numbers to the point where we're no longer in the pandemic situation we were anymore. So, you know, despite the fact that they taught us for years that we were powerless, that we are victims, that one voice doesn't matter, that we're helpless, right? There's a lot of that narrative that comes along. What we saw during the pandemic and the years that followed is that we certainly were not powerless. We, the people of the world, stood up and said, no, thank you. And in fact, we were victors. We ended the pandemic. If the opposition didn't act the way it did, we could still be under the pandemic emergency authorities and still be restricted in travel. Who knows what could have happened? But it took everyone's voice individually and collectively, and it came to an end. Because at the end of the day, our domestic governments are based on the idea that our domestic governments function so long as the people give consent. And when we no longer give consent to the collusion that's happening with the private-public partnerships at the global level, then we have the opportunity to rescind our consent and restore the governments that we have all collectively agreed upon, which allow for individual sovereignty and freedoms.
But the UK has just said, I'm in Sweden, which never had any lockdowns, by the way, and had the lowest excess mortality. And one of the things maybe you can comment about is that they asked a lot of young people in the US and the UK, and they were the most authoritarian. I mean, they wanted more lockdowns, and they were very condemnatory of Scandinavia as being very irresponsible, partly because they've been fed lies, I think. But they were very, and that disappointed me because, you know, this Generation Z or Generation Z is like, they don't believe in freedom anymore. Anyway, maybe you can comment on that because I guess you'll have a lot of young people on. But the UK has just said that they're not going to sign this pandemic treaty. Are there other countries that are joining the UK in this? What about the US?
The U.S. unfortunately, the U.S. unfortunately, we have some senators and representatives who are standing up, but as far as I could tell, the Biden administration is still signing on. There are a few countries in Europe and smaller countries that have rejected it, but I do want to go back to this notion of the younger generation because it's a topic that intrigues me incredibly because most social movements of the past have been driven by the youth. And I do think that there is a planful action from our, you know, from the globalists and the agenda folks, in that the high level of convenience and easiness of, you know, using digital communication and platforms has created compliance. If you look at places in Latin America and more disadvantaged countries, the youth are the ones who are rising up. And so it's about our messaging. It's about how we shape culture and how we get to the youth, because the youth are the key to the future. We need to make sure that our messaging matches the future that they want, or else what are we fighting this for? I mean, we're all fighting this for the next generation and the world we leave. So activating and inspiring the youth population, it's not an effort to be taken lightly. We need to make sure that we are we are meeting them where they're at and igniting that spirit inside of them.
Andrea, we've got about a minute left. Could you summarize and tell us where we can, assuming that there are lots of people in Europe who want to go to Geneva and protest against this pandemic treaty, which may restrict our freedoms considerably, and I think you're doing a thoroughly admirable project. How can we find you on the web, and where should people gather to meet up, and on what date? We've got about a minute left.
Absolutely. So the main website is thegenevaproject.org. But if you are in Europe, we strongly encourage you to go to theroadtogeneva.com. It may be .org. But I'm live, so I forget if it's .com or .org. I think it's .com. Go to the Road to Geneva, and there are waypoints throughout Europe. This is a self-organized people's convoy. So depending on where you're coming from, you can meet up with people from local areas, convoy in together. If you have travel restrictions, there are carpools, there are ride shares. There's so many different creative activities that folks have stimulated to get folks there. We also have Telegram channels in all of the the primary languages across Europe so that there's ease of communication and coordination for the pan-European people's convoy. So the GenevaProject.org and the RoadToGeneva.com.
RoadToGeneva.com and GenevaProject.org. I guess Google Geneva Project. There's probably not many other possibilities there. Thank you very much, Andrea. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
This is the Pelinaros Taylor Show. On to our next guest. I really look forward to following. I wish you best of success there. But we've got our next guest coming up very shortly now, and we will be heading back into the serious politics of the Middle East.
Our beautiful world is changing, withering, dying by the hands of those who don't value nature, even though we all depend on it for life itself. But there is hope. Together with caring friends, the Nature Conservancy can restore our lands, heal our waters, and save our wildlife with big solutions only nature can provide. But every day we lose more of the places we love, and we urgently need to save endangered lands, waters, and wild species. The actions we take today will determine the tomorrow we leave to our children and grandchildren. The water they drink, the air they breathe, the beauty they experience. To learn more about how you can help protect and conserve our beautiful world, visit nature.org today.
Whatever happened to good? It's a word that gets thrown around a lot, and it's become our automatic answer to so much.
Hey, how's things?
Good.
Your mum, your weekend?
Good, good. Is good even that good anymore? At the Salvos, we believe good deserves better. Let's reclaim its true meaning. To us, good has always been about making a difference, and good never picks or chooses who it helps. Isn't it time we all remember what good really means?
Swedish British journalist, filmmaker, political writer, and author of five books, Pelle Nyroff Taylor, on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nyroff Taylor Show. We're going to pivot from the Croisette in the Cannes and the film festival there to the dismal, dank political and geopolitical conflicts of the Middle East. And we've got Brandon Whitechart, who's an expert, he's a geopolitical analyst and author of The Shadow War, Iran's Quest for Supremacy, and he's written several other books. He's the defense and national security policy reporter at The National Interest. Welcome to the show, Brandon. We are going to talk about the death of the Iranian president on a helicopter crash on Sunday evening, I think it was, and whether this is a Franz Ferdinand moment. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit what you meant by that in your very recent article?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. And that article can be found at the Washington Times. It's online today. It'll be in print tomorrow. The argument I'm making is, if you remember, the First World War was really sparked because of the death of a world leader, the assassination of a world leader. Now, I'm not saying that President Ibrahim Raisi was assassinated. In fact, I walk through the evidence how it was probably a freak accident, but the result may very well be the same, which is why I say in the article, the old Mark Twain quote, history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. So there are some differences here, obviously, between what Ferdinand happened to him and what happened to Raisi. But the problem is, given the geopolitical tensions both in the Middle East and the world writ large, it could have the exact same impact on geopolitical events that the death of Franz Ferdinand did.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Franz Ferdinand, of course, was the heir of the Austrian Empire, and he was actually a man of peace. And he was in Bosnia, which was been annexed by the Austrians. And it was not occupied Serbia, but it was had a large Serbian population. And the Princip, Gavril Princip, and his young co-assassins shot him. And I actually just wrote a book about it. And you could actually trace that to Russian intelligence. It went via Serb intelligence, an organization called the Black Hand. And then I think the Russians had prior knowledge. And of course, they were part of an alliance with France and with Britain. So I maintain, I mean, this is not exactly new. It's been written about since the 1920s, but British historians have always tried to make it out that it was the Germans. You know, the Germans are wicked because they speak in funny accents, sort of banal analysis. But I think that you can make a case that it was actually the Allies who were they wanted war. They wanted to hit Germany from both sides simultaneously and had to make the war happen at a particular time. So they planned that assassination. Anyway, but I think that... So I've been warning about a Franz Ferdinand. I'm almost more paranoid than you are. I know that you're talking about you're the bad news guy, you know. So every talk, people, my fans will tell me he's talking about Franz Ferdinand again, or he's talking about a false flag or an political assassination. Of course, and we had Fico last week, didn't he? The Prime Minister of Slovakia, right?
Right.
But you said you looked at the evidence. The Anglo media, the Russian media, are dead quiet about this. And so it could mean that it really is an accident, or it could mean there's almost like an agreement not to big it up and turn it into an event, even if it was an assassination. But can you just talk us through some of your evidence?
Yeah. So, you know, I write a lot about aerospace technology for the National Interest. So I kind of have already a background there. But then I also have several colleagues who were actually pilots, helicopter pilots for U.S. Special Forces. I spoke with one 2 days ago who actually flew Special Forces missions in the same kind of helicopter that crashed. Over mountains, and he was telling me that the Iranian helicopter fleet is very old. It's the helicopter in question is a Bell 212, which is a very popular model, but it's an older model of the American Bell helicopter company. And remember, Iran has been under severe sanctions for decades, and the fleet of American fixed wing and rotary aircraft that they have is not only old, but it's jerry-rigged because they can't get replacement parts directly from U.S. suppliers. So it's very possible that this helicopter was not top of the line. And then you throw in the fact that they're flying over mountains where there's a lot of updraft and there's a lot of issues there already. And then you add in the inclement weather. They were flying in very foggy conditions. You know, it was sort of just playing Russian roulette sort of with the president of Iran's life. It was a freak accident, probably. Of course, you can't rule out espionage, but everything that I've seen, if this was a hit, this was the greatest hit of all time, because there's so much evidence pointing to just human error plus weather plus, you know, bad maintenance on the bird that, you know, it will be the greatest hit of all time.
Well, I'm somebody who says anything's possible, you know, and I believe that a lot of things that are. All governments conduct assassinations and plots, but sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, as I think Freud says. Sometimes accidents are just accidents, and it's best for the world if this is the case. On the other hand, you have to ask why, you know, I sometimes wonder if it's almost like an inside job or something. I mean, you're an expert on Iran. What's the internal dynamics? Are there kind of liberalizing movements in Iran that want to get rid of him and open up the space for reforms?
Well, there's
we can have segue to politics.
There's certainly in the streets of Iran, particularly among the young people, they're celebrating openly his death right now in the streets, particularly in the cities. But ultimately, the regime itself is very, you know, Islamic conservative. Raisi was, from what I understand, he was being groomed to replace the Ayatollah because the Ayatollah is very old. Raisi was a true believer. He started marching with Khomeini in the 70s as a teenager, and then he went on to become this very vicious prosecutor in Hamadan, which is, I think, the third largest city in Iran. And then he went on to become basically the chief justice of the Islamic Supreme Court in Iran, and ultimately was groomed and chosen to be the next president in 2021 by Khamenei himself, who's the Ayatollah right now. And ultimately, my understanding is he was the heir apparent. So his loss would not have probably been orchestrated by the regime, his assassination, if it was an assassination. This would have been, this is a big blow, because he was sort of the quiet heir apparent to the religious leader of Iran, the Ayatollah.
And I'm sort of wondering, I'm just throwing it out, and absolutely no evidence for it. Would I mean, maybe the pilots thought, well, we've got to get rid of this guy and we'll sacrifice our lives for it. Or maybe maybe some of the mechanics thought, well, we'll adjust a bolt here and do something there, and because we're quietly against this guy and we want our freedom. I mean, if you're under 30 in Iran, you must hate the clerical regime.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. There could be something like that at play, although I wouldn't be surprised if Iran is very stern or strict about their vetting process for hiring mechanics and pilots to deal with the presidential fleet. I always say there's more to the story, but in this case, I really think that this could be the spark for a world war, and it's a total freak accident. And that isn't that how most history plays out? It's something that we don't expect being the absolute worst case scenario. And I don't think anybody was anticipating this would happen.
No, absolutely not. Well, I mean, you wrote this book, The Shadow Wars, and obviously a lot of people think, you know, it's Israel, because we know that Israel has assassinated people in Iran, you know, those scientists for quite a long time, and knocking out those revolutionary guards in Damascus just last month, I think it was. Antennae show Israel, indicate Israel.
Well, so, you know, initially I was asking people that I knew, and usually with those hits that you're talking about, there's usually, however subtle, there's usually the so-called fingerprints of, a hit. Even if it's very subtle, you can kind of know, okay, this was an intelligence operation. There so far has not been any indication of that. I know there's some talk about this person walking around the crash site, but from what I have heard is that that was a paramedic, that they had a lot of rescue people, and it wasn't a very well-coordinated rescue effort either. It was kind of a mess, but they had people walking all over the place looking for this helicopter, flying over it, driving near it. So there's really not much evidence of sort of the fingerprints that you would see of espionage or some kind of hit involved. Again, maybe there was, but so far from what I have heard and seen, there's no indication of that. It doesn't mean, though, that the effect will still be the same. It means that probably it doesn't matter. They're interpreting this in Iran as this was a hit.
Are they?
It sounds like the government is.
Ah, okay. Okay, I know Press TV is available, but I haven't looked at it.
To me, it looks like what might be happening is the Iranian government is embarrassed because it was clearly a tech failure. They were using an American helicopter to ferry the president around. So it's really kind of an embarrassment. So they're trying to deflect. Now, there hasn't been overwhelming statements blaming Israel, but there has been several statements made that indicate that they believe something suspicious happened. And over there, that's sort of the beginning of how they create these conspiracy theories. But it makes sense that they wouldn't want to be blamed for their own president's death. They'd be looking to kind of deflect over to their number one enemy, which is Israel.
Right. And so far, none of these rumbles in Iran have reached the mainstream Western media, nor even the Russian media. But it's interesting that it's boiling underneath the surface. So it's really worth keeping an eye on that, because, of course, it could, if the Iranians decide to do something, then we could be onto World War III. But just to move a little bit away from that, do you think they've got to have elections now within a couple of weeks, 50 days, I think it is?
Yeah.
Are there any candidates? Do you know anything about the political scene inside Iran?
Yes, I do know a little bit. Right now, they're really at a loss for who to get on such short notice. I know that the number two for Raisi is kind of taking over as interim president, but he's not really that impressive. He's kind of just a yes man. He's a placeholder. They're going to be looking, but I think that's also why they might not be so violently blaming Israel, because right now it's a very precarious situation. They lost their president, who was a real stringent ideologue, very strong leader for that regime. They're looking for someone. It's a very precarious moment. And also the people are celebrating the death of this president in the streets. So that regime's got to balance their desire to kind of poke Israel and kind of keep the geopolitical tensions in the region going with the need to find a replacement, because right now they don't really have a deep bench. And so that's sort of the internal crisis that is afflicting the regime right now. This is a very dangerous moment for the regime.
So well, I don't know how you pronounce it, Khamenei, the supreme leader who has most of the real power.
Yeah, I think it's Khamenei or Khamenei.
Khamenei. Okay, yeah, so like he's this 84-year-old guy, cleric, who's been around since forever, and he apparently wields the real power under this sort of dual theocratic structure that Iran has, with religious guys. The president doesn't have all that much power, and he was the one who was killed or died.
No.
I read in one analysis that Khamenei he was surrounded by hardliners, and as a result, he didn't have any room for maneuver. But if he brought in some kind of liberals, relative liberals, that would open up the space for a more dynamic Iranian regime, if you like. And if things went wrong, Khamenei could blame the liberals and fire him. So there's a kind of optimistic picture, I guess, or a copium.
That would be my hope to a point. But we have to remember the last kind of quote unquote liberal president they had was Rouhani, and Rouhani opened up all of his campaign speeches with "death to America" chants, "death to Israel." So you know, even the kind of appointed liberals that the regime has toyed with in the past, they're pretty radical. And we have to remember the ideological underpinnings of the regime really don't allow for the kind of liberalization that you and I would hope for, which is why I think the people are protesting, because they realize there's no hope of liberalization with the current regime because they're very stuck in their ways. And so he might try that. You might be onto something, but ultimately even a quote unquote liberal is not going to be as liberal as would be needed to really transform the country from the top.
These celebrations in Iran, are they happening openly in Tehran? And secondly, do you think it'll convert into something more enduring as a protest? And is America backing this, or is it coming too much out of the blue, this killing, for the Americans to have something organized?
The Americans have nothing to do with this. And under Biden, because he wants to deal with the current regime, just like Obama did when the 2009 protests erupted, there's no possible way that the Americans are going to get behind this movement. But this movement is enduring and it's growing. It's been going on for years underneath the surface. I liken it to what was going on in China during that led to the Tiananmen Square massacre. The question will be, does the regime have the kind of power that the Chinese regime did to squelch the protests that are coming? And I don't know. I think the Iranian regime, especially now, they've lost Soleimani, they've lost Raisi. They've really only got this 84-year-old Ayatollah now, who's kind of the iconic leader. I don't know if they have the juice to kind of crush a truly popular revolt. And this could be the opening that the liberals in Iran at the street level need to overthrow their government. And hopefully it happens, and hopefully it's relatively bloodless.
It's interesting that the... because Iran's been on a roll in terms of the regime's own definition of its power, because they've just opened this transport route between India and Russia via Azerbaijan, trading corridor. I mean, they're fortifying, the heartland powers are fortifying themselves vis-a-vis the Atlantic powers. So they feel they might be doing quite well, Raisi was quite influential in that. We've got a minute and a half left.
Yeah.
What about the foreign minister? Was he an influential figure? Because, of course, he was killed as well in this crash, and much less has been heard about him. But I've seen him being interviewed. He's been quite a media figure for Iranian standards.
He wasn't as kind of known as Raisi, or Soleimani for the IRGC. But yes, he was a pretty serious figure. He was the one that was kind of leading the Iranian chants against Israel since October 7th. So yeah, it's a loss. I mean, they've really, and of course, the Iranians have done very well, as you note, in foreign policy. It's just ironic that internally they're not doing so well with domestic policy. So this is a big blow for them.
Mm. Well, what else should we've got about a minute left? What else should we be looking for then as the next spike or something that we could people are not watching it immediately, but what do you expect to happen then in the next 2 weeks or something? Got about a minute left.
In the region, I would be watching out for an increase in terrorist attacks through the Iranian-backed Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthi groups. I would be very worried if I were European or American about dirty bomb and kind of terrorist attacks at home.
Hmm. terrorist attacks at home. What do you mean by that? In our own countries, in Europe?
In our own countries, we have a lot of Hezbollah and Hamas operating here illegally in the United States, coming up through the broken border. I know they're all throughout Europe and Britain, so they might decide to retaliate by doing that.
Okay, well, we'll certainly know if it's happened or not. Brandon Weichart, thank you very much. Iranian expert in Iran. Love to have you on again as this story develops. It's not dead yet, as we sort of thought after the calming words both on the Russian media and the British and American media. It's bubbling under, and it could yet be a Franz Ferdinand moment. As you said, thank you very much, Brandon. Love to have you
thank
on again.
You.
This is the Pelinerov Teleshow on Tuesday afternoon on this lovely May spring day.